Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. A new art form emerged in 15th century Florence through the genius of Luca della Robbia, exalting the humble material of clay with brilliant modeling and surfaces shining with color that seems to defy time. The first comprehensive exhibition of della Robbia work in the United States, originating at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston and taking new form at the National Gallery of Art, shows how three generations of Luca's family of skilled artists and entrepreneurs responding to international demand created magnificent sculpture in glazed terracotta. To celebrate opening day on February 5th, 2017, Allison Lux explores the human sensitivity, spirit-lifting color, and technical ingenuity that secure the appeal of della Robbia sculpture into the 21st century. Della Robbia, Sculpting with Color in Renaissance Florence, is on view through June 4th, 2017.
I'm Allison Lux, curator of early European sculpture here at the gallery, and we're happy to welcome you to the first comprehensive exhibition of della Robbia glazed terracotta sculpture in the United States. I'd like to begin by thanking the sponsors who helped make this show possible and to whom we're very grateful. But I'd also like to acknowledge some others who helped to make it possible. Our designers, registrars, conservators, and especially the heroic art handlers who have raised tons of terracotta into the air, and the mount makers who've worked to make sure it will stay up there. Our title begins simply with della Robbia, no first name. A friend from a different field asked, so what did della Robbia do? The question is, what did they do? The della Robbia were a family of artists who created a new form of sculpture in glazed terracotta. They practiced it for three generations and made it one of the most characteristic creations of their native city, Florence. They had the rare combination of talents to succeed as inventors, entrepreneurs, and above all, artists. The exhibition also includes works by another family, the Buglioni, who learned some of the della Robbia technical secrets, whether by stealth or training, and became their competitors. Where the della Robbia name is known in this country, their sculpture often has the reputation of comfortable, popular, decorative art. As one friend put it, the blue and white stuff. And you've probably seen holiday decorations made of greenery and fruit, known as della Robbia wreaths. Handmade versions have been sold since 1923 by Boys Republic, an organization that provides education and vocational training for at-risk youth. While the perception, blue and white, colorful botanical ornament, is not wrong, it's not the whole story. In their own time, the della Robbia's brightly colored clay sculpture stood out as cutting-edge innovation. The architect and art theorist, Leon Battista Alberti, whose self-portrait is here in the gallery, returned to Florence from exile in 1434 and discovered a city with an art scene that filled him with excitement. He named a few contemporaries who he thought measured up to the great artists of antiquity. They were Filippo Brunelleschi, the architect of the cathedral, the sculptor Donatello, the painter Masaccio, whose frescoes are in the Brancacci Chapel in Santa Maria del Carmine, Lorenzo Ghiberti, the maker of the Gates of Paradise, and Luca della Robbia. Alberti wrote that, though, in 1436, even before Luca had developed his great invention, glazed terracotta sculpture, which inspired this exhibition. The idea for a della Robbia exhibition came from a brilliant curator of European sculpture at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Marietta Cambereri. Studying the fine examples of della Robbia glazed terracotta sculpture in the Museum of Fine Arts, she realized that Boston collectors had played a key role in bringing della Robbia sculptures to America and presenting them to an American public. One of the founders of the Boston Museum, Charles Callahan Perkins, was the author of a book on Tuscan sculpture in 1864, one of whose heroes was Luca della Robbia, And Perkins gave three Della Robbia sculptures to the Museum of Fine Arts when it opened in 1876, some of the earliest ones to reach the United States. Actually, his are not even in the show. This one he gave, but that's back in Boston. These three are in the show, and we'll come back to them. Another American scholar, Alan Marcon, wrote a 7-volume study of the Della Robbia, which is still fundamental today. So Dr. Cambereri thought of organizing an exhibition of Della Robbia sculpture in America. And she set out to select the best examples available among the dozens in public and private collections in this country. At the National Gallery, we were excited about collaborating on this first American exhibition of Della Robbia glazed terracotta sculpture. Three of our founding donors, Andrew Mellon, Samuel H. Kress, and the Widener family, had contributed examples, and you'll see 5 of those in the exhibition. They include one relief with a particularly illustrious provenance, an adoration that belonged to the celebrated English writer, art critic, and artist John Ruskin, who had it sent to him from Florence in 1880 and displayed it in his study as one of the most precious things I have. For connoisseurs like Ruskin and for American collectors, to own a Della Robbia was to own a little of Renaissance Florence with its great traditions of art and craftsmanship. So it was important to include a few choice works from Italy to give an idea of what travelers from other countries would have seen that inspired them to bring Della Robbia works home. Dr. Cambereri secured some loans that border on the miraculous, especially the Visitation by Luca, from a church in Pistoia, about 1/2 hour from Florence, which had never left Italy before it went to Boston last summer. We'll come back to that too. But we're especially grateful to the town of Pistoia because in 2017, they are the cultural capital of Italy, and they still let the Visitation come not only to Boston, but also to the National Gallery, one of their greatest treasures. It's going to go home in triumph in the summer. So we'll look now at the Della Robbia family members in the exhibition and consider what each generation brought to the art form invented by the founding father, Luca. We'll see the kinds of sculpture they made, how it fit the needs of their audience, how they went about making it, and turning its production into an international business. The Della Robbia developed their sculpture in a time and place, 15th century Florence, where the objects that we now set apart in museums as works of art were perceived not just as a luxury or an investment or even a vehicle of self-expression for the artists. In 15th century Italy, painting and sculpture were in demand to serve widespread social needs, and they were something that people almost took for granted and lived with from day to day. In their homes, people placed images of the Madonna and Child as a focus for prayer and a comforting source of divine protection. They might also acquire busts of holy figures as protectors of the family, such as the city patron, St. John the Baptist, or the Christ Child as a good example for their children. In the case of this bust of a little boy, we're not actually sure if he's a Christ Child or a portrait bust. There may have been an interest in portraits of children as well. In the churches, or something else for the homes, they might have statuettes that represented civic values. Judith was a particular heroine to the Florentines because she conquered a much stronger tyrant. Images of abundance might be in people's homes to celebrate prosperity and fertility. And small images of the Christ Child and John the Baptist, again, were there for children's education. So people lived with these things that had meaning for them, not simply as decorations. In the churches, there was a need for large-scale images, not just paintings, but reliefs and statues, to stand above the altars where Mass was said, to remind people of the essential tenets of the faith, to tell the sacred stories, and to present holy exemplars and intercessors, the saints. Set into the wall of a church, there might be a tabernacle to create an honorable place to preserve the and shelter the sacrament, which was so essential to the Mass. And elsewhere in churches, relief images of symbolic figures such as virtues might become sculptural decoration that could be built into the walls and ceilings, the smooth surfaces of what was then modern architecture in Renaissance chapels. And outdoors, on the walls of buildings that housed civic and religious corporations, works of sculpture could proclaim the identity of the patrons who supported a building through coats of arms, or announce the building's purpose as they brightened the streets of the city. Florence was a city that took pride in invention, in taking familiar crafts and changing them into something new and even more desirable. Florentines bought both raw wool and finished cloth from Northern Europe and refined it into luxury textiles. Luca della Robbia came from a family whose traditional profession was in textile work, which is perhaps hinted at in this child's carefully tailored clothes and in the print patterns stenciled in the background in paint on the fired terracotta of this work. If you look at our Fra Angelico Madonna, which is over in the West Building, and compare the print pattern in the cloth in the background, it's somewhat similar. Luca, however, discovered possibilities in a different humble material, clay. This is the back of that Madonna from the Bargello. I'd love to think that's Luca's handprint. He found ways to turn it into a new kind of sculpture that, as Vasari wrote, was unknown even to the great artists of classical antiquity. Luca was born around 1400. Since he grew up to launch a workshop that developed over three generations, it's amusing to think that he must have been a maverick in his own family. Instead of sticking with their traditional profession, the wool trade, he turned to sculpture. We don't know for sure who trained him in modeling and carving, but by the time he reached his 20s, he was working on projects for the central religious buildings of the city, the cathedral and baptistry. There's a theory that he assisted Nanni di Banco with marble carving on the exterior of the Duomo, perhaps some of the musical angels. And there's a document of 1427 that suggests he collaborated on the early stages of Ghiberti's bronze doors, known as the Gates of Paradise. In the 1430s, Luca had the standing to get an important commission of his own for the interior of the cathedral, to create a marble balcony called a cantoria, meaning singing gallery, but perhaps actually an organ loft, to go above one of two sacristy doors in the crossing, so at the very center of the cathedral. To decorate his cantoria, he carved 10 reliefs of boys and girls making music, carved in marble, figures that suggest careful study of both ancient sculpture and living models. His competitor on the second organ loft to go across the aisle was no less than Donatello, and their reliefs are always a favorite compare and contrast topic for art history students, but I won't do it here. It was while this work was in progress that Alberti named Luca, along with Donatello, in 1436, among the modern artists not inferior to the ancients, which was the highest praise he could give. At this point, so far as we know, Luca is primarily a marble carver. Before he was finished with the musical reliefs, the cathedral hired him to contribute marble reliefs to decorate the lower registers of the campanile, the bell tower of the cathedral. This was to complete a series begun in the 14th century, a series of reliefs celebrating the creation of the world and the activities of humanity, which included planets, arts, sciences, virtues, professions, and sacraments. As Luca planned the reliefs he was going to make for this program, he must have looked carefully at the older reliefs, about 100 years old, looking at a group of reliefs created by Andrea Pisano. This is one of Luca's reliefs for the campanile. But he must have paid a lot of attention to these reliefs by Andrea Pisano of around 1340, with marble figures against backgrounds of blue glazed terracotta, baked clay. The Madonna in Lunette and the Reliefs of Virtues. I singled out the Pisano relief of Prudence because you can see this two-headed figure who is a medieval ancestor of the cover girl for our exhibition catalog, Prudence, with two faces, one looking forward and one looking back. Luca must have been impressed by those 100-year-old reliefs with white figures standing out against blue-glazed grounds. In 1441, soon after the Campanile assignment, we find his first documented work using glazed terracotta, both for background and for ornament. This was a tabernacle for the Church of Santa Maria Nuova, not far from the Duomo. It's now been moved to the church at Peretola near Florence. A wall-mounted structure to shelter the bread for the sacrament. What particularly stands out is the semicircular lunette with a group of figures representing the lamentation over the dead Christ, which Luca carved in relief in white marble and surrounded with blue glazed terracotta. And above it, also in terracotta, he placed a jewel-like garland of cherubs with garlands of flowers and painted tiles because Luca was a good painter with his glazes as well. The lunette image may have helped win Luca the chance to try a more dramatic experiment with glazed terracotta sculpture in the cathedral itself. The Cathedral Board of Works wasn't done with those sacristy doors. They wanted to place multi-figured images of the resurrection and the ascension of Christ on one on each side of the crossing above the sacristy doors. That presented a difficult artistic problem because those images would have to be set under the organ lofts on which Luca and Donatello had just worked, and so they would be overshadowed. So the question was, what could they put there that people in the nave would be able to see and read? Painting would fade, marble or bronze would blur. There was such a thing as painted terracotta sculpture, but that too would have been submerged in shadows under those projecting balconies. But Luca della Robbia had a solution. Gleaming white glazed terracotta figures against deep blue shining out through the darkness. The Cathedral Operae, the managers, were so pleased with his resurrection that they hired him to make the ascension to go above the other door, this time with a stipulation in the contract that the hills and trees, which are here white, should be rendered in their own colors. Thus, the ascension relief has green and brown landscape elements. These sharp, clear images fitted to the architectural surfaces, to the arch surfaces above the doors, must have pleased Brunelleschi, the architect of the cathedral. Luca had developed an art form that provides clearly readable images that can fuse with architecture and accentuate its forms and proportions without obstructing the space. Luca went on to provide terracotta reliefs of the apostles in white relief against blue for the walls of Brunelleschi's Pazzi Chapel at the Church of Santa Croce. Luca's work began there in 1445, just a year before Brunelleschi's death. But surely there must have been collaborative planning on this. We don't know when Luca first began to experiment with glazed terracotta. It must have taken a while to perfect his method. He chose a light-colored, high-calcium clay, they call it a marly clay, that seems to have come from the bed of the Arno River, the Della Robbia-owned land along the Arno outside the city. Preparing the clay was a demanding job. As Abigail Hyken discusses vividly in the exhibition catalog, the clay had to be cleaned, repeatedly mixed with water, and drained in sieves, then dried, ground, pounded, and mixed with soft river sand. While the prepared clay was wet, it could be formed either by hand modeling or by pressing into molds, or a combination of both processes, since a molded image before it dried could be worked in detail by hand and with tools. After that, it would be fired to harden the image, which could then be covered with glazes and fired again to create brilliantly colored, shining surfaces. The techniques Luca studied to invent this method must have included glazed pottery and tiles, but perhaps also the shining enameled sculpture on precious religious metalwork. We have a wonderful example in our own collection, whose principal color in many cases was gleaming white. The terms glazed and enameled are both used to describe works commissioned from the Della Robbia. Sometimes both terms are used in the same contract. Luca developed a formula for his glazes, for glazes that bind well with a particular light-colored clay during firing. The glaze and the clay expand and contract at related rates to prevent cracking and detachment and to make the bond between them strong and lasting. In later Della Robbia works, the pale clay was sometimes supplemented with areas of more ordinary red clay, but often with the lighter clay closer to the glaze. For the glazes, the main ingredients are silicon, the material of sand and glass, and oxides of lead and tin, both in higher percentages than would be used for maiolica pottery. Della Robbia work really isn't just pottery. To simplify, the tin oxide gives whiteness and opacity, and the lead makes it shine. Luca found a ratio of tin and lead oxides to make surfaces with the glassy hardness of that goldsmith ornament, enamel. The main areas of glaze would go on in a single thick layer, which would be fired into a hard, bright, opaque, shining surface that often has a dimpled texture, which Abby compares to clotted cream. If you look closely, you'll see that it's not just smooth. There is a lovely, lively, vibrating, dimpled look to it. The materials are knowable, but the secret is no single formula. It lies in the interaction of several processes, of the combining of relative amounts of materials and the special relationship of Luca's glazes to the carefully selected and prepared clay. Adding metal compounds allowed a limited but harmonious palette: cobalt for blue, copper for green, lead and for green, antimony for yellow, manganese for purple, and iron for brown. They didn't use red. Red glaze is really hard to control, but red could be painted on after firing when they wanted it. And details such as textile patterns or plants in a grassy lawn could be painted in glazes before firing, or even added in paint afterwards, as well as gilding could also be added. And those glaze colors stay as fresh and bright as the day they came from the kiln. Vasari, the 16th century art historian, wrote a life of Luca that perhaps hurt Luca's reputation by providing some fairly mundane reasons why the artist took up glazed terracotta. Vasari says, he felt himself drawn by nature to new things and by necessity to an exercise both less fatiguing and more profitable. But glazed terracotta actually calls for a lot of work and a lot of risk, and it has its own virtues that marble and bronze can't claim. A shining, clear luminosity, color if the patron chooses, visibility and legibility across dark and distance. And it endures, almost everlasting, Vasari says. He calls it this beautiful invention, so lovely and so useful, above all for places where there is water and where, because of damp and other reasons, there is no scope for paintings. When you walk through Florence, you see it set into walls outdoors, still blooming after 500 years. Luca soon realized that glazed terracotta could be used not only for relief sculpture on walls, but for statues in the round, and that he could do things with it that were not easily done in marble. For instance, make connected, interacting figures. And so we have his Visitation, a pair of conjoined statues in the round, which was made for a confraternity, a society of lay people associated with a church who meet for prayer and charitable activity in the nearby town of Pistoia. You see it here in its modern location above an altar in the church there of San Giovanni Fuor Civitas. Its original location and placement is unknown, but it might have been something like this. The sculpture represents a story from the Gospel of St. Luke, in which the Virgin Mary, miraculously pregnant with Jesus, goes to help her aged kinswoman Elizabeth, miraculously pregnant with John the Baptist, after being barren for all of her long life. When they meet, Elizabeth declares, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the child you will bear. Why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to me? As soon as the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby in my womb leaped for joy." And Luca imagines Elizabeth falling to her knees before the younger woman in her excitement as they gaze at each other intensely with such understanding of what's happening and such affection for each other. The psychological connection is intensified by the way this sculpture is constructed in four sections that fit together, with each woman's hands modeled as part of the upper body of the other. And I show you some shots of what our handlers had to do to put it together. The first two pieces, the upper half of Elizabeth, and you see that Mary's hand is part of the upper half of Elizabeth. And then finally, the whole group. And you see Elizabeth's hand as part of Mary. And from this angle, you can see the joins, which from the front and the other side are really invisible. It's quite extraordinary. Mary, very young, very graceful, gazes down in selfless compassion at the aged Elizabeth, looking completely at peace with what's happening to her. It's perhaps one of the most moving images of human connection ever created in the 15th century or any other time. Luca did not limit his statues to gleaming white figures that might be taken as competitors for marble. He could also make multicolored statuettes like this lovely, very young Madonna from the Oratory of San Tommaso in Florence. Dressed in cheering colors, but again, as with Mary and Elizabeth, there's a contrast in expressions, this time between a happy, playful, squirming child, looking quite convincing, and a mother who stares into space as though she sees ahead, as though she foresees what's going to happen to her child. And this was made explicit in the very sensitive installation in Boston in which our Pietà, the older Mary holding the dead Christ in her lap, was depicted or placed in a position that allowed you to see it in the same gaze with this Madonna. In addition to these large-scale works, the glazed terracotta medium offered possibilities for smaller reliefs of a kind every home in Florence needed, as I mentioned. Images of the Madonna and Child, for instance, including individually modeled masterworks like this one in the Bargello, which is, by the way, is in a, what seems to be its original tabernacle frame, worth taking a look at when you see it up there. Very, very old wooden frame. And Luca discovered that his models could be replicated by taking molds from them with plaster and then pressing wet clay into the molds. So in the exhibition, you'll see two pairs of relief in the show that allow us to explore an important aspect of Della Robbia work, serial sculpture. This does not imply low-grade mechanical replication, because even sculptures that emerge from the same mold could be individualized by handwork on details while the clay is still wet and by differences in glazing, as is clear in this pair. There are signs of experimentation in this pair of Madonna by Lucas, particularly include the treatment of the eyes. In the New York Madonna, the blue eyes have run a little bit, giving a kind of dreamy look. In the Boston Madonna, you'll see that they're sharply outlined and clear so that the figures look more alert. Whether this was a matter of an accident of the flow of the glazes or deliberate expressive effort, we don't know for sure. We also have a pair of examples of Luca's Madonna of the Lilies. And when we brought them together, we were thinking they had come from the same mold and were just variations. But it turns out to be a lot more complicated than that, as you'll see when you're up there, both for differences in scale and for differences in the details. In this version, there's a lot more interest in spatial recession, for instance, in the cushion, in the way the plant is designed, and you'll see differences in the hairstyles and expressions of the Madonnas. It really turns out to be quite extraordinary and interesting differences. The way that the sculptors might interact with the patrons who wanted these reliefs is suggested by a few documents from private purchasers of Della Robbia sculpture. Those documents are very late, from 1524, but they may shed some light on earlier conditions. They tell us something about the demand for both unique custom-made sculptures and for works kept in stock for the market. The drawing on the screen is by Fra Mattia Della Robbia, Andrea's oldest son, who was working in Rome in 1524. It's a design and contract for a commission for a Madonna and Child, listing specific details about what the patron wanted included in his image. He wanted a Madonna and Child with a young St. John the Baptist and a Dominican nun of San Sisto holding a scroll with an inscription. And he wanted borders with cherubim and yet another border with a fruit garland. The work in question is lost, but I show you a Madonna relief in Messina, which at least has the kind of double borders that this patron wanted. The contract stipulated that Mattia's work had to be better in appearance than the design, and Mattia was to present the modeled clay in 2 weeks and the final glazed version a month and a half after that, which is interesting because it suggests that the glazing took longer. Meanwhile, back in Florence, the friend of a prospective client writes to him, "I went to the Della Robbia and saw the molds of some very dignified coats of arms. They cost from 6 or 7 to 7 lira each. Then you say you want a Madonna to put in the main room. There's one for 2 florins and another for 3, with space to include the arms. As soon as I can, I will ask for drawings of both and send them to you for your lordship's decision." So by this time, a patron could buy a ready-made Madonna relief or perhaps order one from a mold and have it personalized with family arms. And what I show you is not one done for that patron, but our own Andrea Della Robbia Adoration, because it has the coats of arms of a married couple who were married in 1477. And this could be added on request. Luca Della Robbia passed his sculptural practice on to Andrea, who was not his son, but his nephew. Luca never married. And Andrea was one of several children of his late brother, whom Luca took in. Andrea was in the workshop by 1451 at the age of 16 and had pretty much taken over around 1470 when Luca was in poor health. Andrea pursued an increasingly particularized and elegant naturalism and explored a wider range of expressions. It's sometimes not so easy to distinguish between them. Something that can be a clue, though it isn't a guarantee, is that Luca generally preferred blue or gray eyes, and Andrea liked these lovely hazel eyes, which have an almost golden look. And the kind of naturalism Andrea pursued is evident in the eyelashes he glazed on the child in our Madonna relief. This lovely round Madonna relief belongs to us, and I'm so happy. It's one of our best Della Robbias, and it's ours. This example from the Toledo Museum is fascinating because it's been attributed to both Luca and Andrea, and it's really hard to be sure which one it is. The simple costume and the blue-gray eyes are like Luca, but the very naturalistic and self-possessed child suggests Andrea, and it's not impossible that they both worked on it. I'm especially fascinated by the child's hand, which is visible through his mother's veil, which makes me think of the veiled nun from the Corcoran, admittedly done in marble, but Andrea was doing, or Luca or Andrea, doing something like this in the 15th century. The owners of that relief, the Toledo relief, in the 19th century were the Viviani family, which had absorbed the Della Robbia family through marriage in the 17th century. And I would love to think that that's a Della Robbia family heirloom that came all the way down from the Renaissance. We can't prove it, but it's one of a kind and exceptionally good. The animated child in this relief reminds us that Andrea is best known for a series of roundels of swaddled babies that were made to decorate the long portico, the loggia, of the Ospedale degli Innocenti, the foundling home in Florence. So another instance of outdoor sculpture that fit into the architecture of Brunelleschi, even though it was put there long after his death. These reliefs are from 1487. And they seem very well to suit the Brunelleschi building and to bring it to life while telling its purpose. Thus, strongly individualized children, swaddled children, have not just differently colored blankets, but different personalities. Andrea had 12 children, so he had plenty of opportunity to study children, and it shows here. Five of them joined the profession, by the way, five that we know of. They became sculptors. The Innocenti children were recently taken down for conservation, and if you go to Florence, you'll see them newly cleaned, and you'll be able to see two of them cleaned close up in the Museum of the Innocenti. Question of whether those will go back up or stay down there where people can look at them. Haven't seen them yet, and I'm very excited to. These reliefs, of course, don't travel, but in the exhibition, we can compare the cherub heads from a private collection, probably from an altarpiece frame by Andrea, and also the marvelously individual bust of a little boy who, even if he was made as a Christ child, must have been made by studying a living model, a child known to the sculptor. Andrea did a lot of portraits or portrait-like heads, which are quite wonderful in the show, both ideally beautiful, but with distinctive and some with distinctive personalities. I love this aged saint from the Nelson Atkins Museum. He looks like somebody who, as I say to people, he'd give you a very tough time, but has a heart of gold. Andrea, besides, enriched the sculpture of the botanical surrounds that Luca began and that most people who've heard of the Della Robbia identify with them, as you see in these two. Andrea was a practical entrepreneur who developed Luca's production of sculpture in sections, which made it possible to ship Della Robbia works all over Italy and beyond and install them in situ to meet the demand that had grown up. In the wonderful relief of Prudence from the Metropolitan, the conservators who prepared it for the show discovered numbers engraved in the clay before firing, which seemed to be guides to the installers on the order in which to put the border together. And when they discovered these, they changed the order so that if you take your exhibition catalog up into the exhibition and look at Prudence, you'll see that the sections of fruit are in a different order than they are in the catalog. The photograph is pre-conservation. For Luca and Andrea, making sacred images was a business, but not just a business. They were both devout Catholic believers. Luca owned books that included Dante's Vita Nuova and medieval devotional poems. Andrea's work was apparently touched by his close contact with the two great preaching orders, the Franciscans and the Dominicans. He spent more than 10 years making and installing altarpieces for the Franciscan convent at the mountain sanctuary of La Verna, a pilgrimage site in the Tuscan wilderness where St. Francis of Assisi received the stigmata in 1224. Andrea worked for the Franciscan friars of La Verna from about 1475 to 1486. Then in the 1490s, Andrea became a follower and supporter of a friar from a different religious order, Savonarola, the Dominican preacher who attacked corruption in the church and called for reform in Florentine life and government. Savonarola urged Florentines to turn away from luxury and embrace a simple, devout, charitable way of life. And you'll know he incited the burning of luxury objects and works of art that he thought appealed to the senses more than the spirit. In one of his sermons, Savonarola had some harsh words for contemporary religious art. He preached, "You put all the vanities in the church. Do you believe the Virgin Mary went dressed this way as you paint her? I tell you, she went dressed as a poor woman, simply, and so covered that her face could hardly be seen. You would do well to cancel these figures that are painted so unchastely." Andrea seems to have taken Savonarola's admonitions to heart and looked for ways to apply his ideals in his sculpture. One example may be something like this later version of our Madonna, in which the Virgin now wears a heavier veil knotted on her chest and an extra shawl, still beautiful but more heavily covered than in the earlier version. And another change in Andrea's work is in the 1490s, the period when Savonarola was preaching, is what I call the return to earth. He begins to make sculptures in partially glazed terracotta, leaving the flesh parts unglazed. They are sometimes painted, but it still makes the flesh areas both more naturalistic and less exalted. These figures no longer manifest Luca's luminous, eternal whiteness. Instead, they appear more vulnerable and human. They remind us that humans are made of the dust of the earth, of clay. And we see this idea taken up in the work of Andrea's successors, in our Pietà, in this angel, in a Madonna by one of the competitors, the Buglioni, and in the trio of three robust Franciscan preaching saints from the mid-16th century with their bare clay faces, hands, and feet. We even see it in a Franciscan coat of arms where the shield with the crossed hands of St. Francis and Jesus are placed on a bare clay ground. Andrea did not abandon the white glaze for flesh tones. It was simply an alternative. In this wonderful Mother of Sorrows, the expressive use of colors in a heavily veiled grieving figure seems to me something that Savonarola would certainly have approved. I love the colors of this because the blues are so sorrowful, and so is the dark red dress, and yet the green lining seems to give a note of hope that you don't see in the facial expression. The later Della Robbia also made secular sculpture. As demand for their work spread beyond Florence, Andrea's sons carried the family invention to other countries, especially to France. Andrea's son Girolamo went to work for King Francis I, who prized Italian artists, including Leonardo da Vinci. In the 1520s, Francis began building a palace near Paris and hired Girolamo to decorate the outer walls with roundels of ancient rulers. The palace was destroyed during the revolution, but we have a number of Girolamo's portrait heads from the palace of a courtier of Francis. This one comes from that palace, the Chateau de Sansac. We see Francis in his court finery and plumed hat, and a group of other heads that may be ideal or portraits that seem to come from that same program of Francis's courtier, the Chateau de Sansac in 1529. We thought that this bust belonged to the program, but bringing the works together for the show allows us to learn things, and we realized that both the treatment of the curls and the glaze on this figure, as well as the truncation, are very different. So this one may be from the Italian Della Robbia after all. As you compare them in the show, you'll be reminded that Girolamo, working in France, had to learn to use different kind of clay and maybe different glaze materials too. So the surface is quite different, and there's a kind of fine craquelure in his glaze that's different from the shiny, white, continuous glaze. The workshop back in Florence continued to prosper under the leadership of Andrea's second oldest son, Giovanni. The oldest son, Mattia, became a friar, so he couldn't run the shop. Giovanni made many smaller objects for homes, such as statuettes to proclaim Florentine values, as I mentioned, abundance or the heroic Judith, and statuettes to contribute to the education of children, these well-behaved and devout little boys, the Christ Child and John the Baptist. Giovanni also took on artistic problems and themes that became central in the High Renaissance. One was landscape, hinted at in the little waterfall and the stream that flows down in this very small sculpture. Practice, and the other was ideal and heroic human figures. I urge you to go to Baltimore, not far away, to see this wonderful Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden by Giovanni della Robbia that combines figures and landscape. This one couldn't travel, but what could travel is Giovanni's Resurrection of Christ, which the Brooklyn Museum has so generously lent to us. This is a triumphant display of the full range of what the della Robbia technique could do in terms of colors, dynamic figures in action, and settings studied from nature. The heroic semi-nude Christ rising surrounded by a blue and golden radiance in a garden landscape just before sunrise. I love that pale grayish-white sky. And around him, the strongly individualized guards in antique armor, some lying asleep, some jolted awake. Under the blessing right hand of Christ is an assertive portrait figure of a contemporary Florentine in prayer, a member of the patrician Antinori family who commissioned the relief. He may be Niccolo Antinori, or who began the villa, or Niccolo's son Alessandro. I personally think it's likely to be a portrait of Niccolo commissioned by Alessandro after his father's death in 1520 as a way to commemorate his father in perpetual prayer in hopes of securing his salvation. The scene with its wide range of colors is surrounded by a burgeoning garland of fruits and vegetables and also inhabited by animals. There are birds, there's a crab, a frog, a squirrel, and you'll have a good time hunting for them when you go up there. At the corners are coats of arms of the Antinori family, whose names live on as they continue a 500-year-old tradition of arts patronage and wine production. I wondered if it's accidental that each coat of arms seems to be sprouting a bunch of grapes. Giovanni must have known the blue and white resurrection reliefs by Luca and Andrea, the first above a door in the cathedral, the second above a lamentation painting in a church. But Giovanni's resurrection clearly belongs to a different world. The rather audacious portrait figure may have been possible if the relief was meant for a private secular setting. And in fact, the earliest record of Giovanni's resurrection in the 19th century places it at the Antinori Villa, Le Rose, just outside Florence. The question is, where would you install such a relief at a villa? Just to give you an idea of the range of possibilities. The writer who saw it in 1892 mentions he had seen it a few years earlier placed above the gateway or door to the garden on the inner side. So, let's see. One possibility is this place under the portico. The Brooklyn conservators took this picture where this upper section is modern, and you can see brackets, which would have allowed it to be placed under the arched setting of the portico. So perhaps that's the original location. We don't know for sure. But the emphasis on plants and landscape certainly make placement near a garden convincing. And we've tried to honor that by installing it above the entrance to the West Garden Court. To do it, we had to do some experimentation on the appropriate height. And since the resurrection weighs over 1,000 pounds, we used a cardboard maquette to figure out exactly how high it ought to go. The Antinori, whose Renaissance ancestors commissioned the resurrection, are major supporters of the exhibition. It's wonderful to have a descendant of someone represented in the work of art as actually one of the supporters. And in fact, who are the Brooklyn conservators at work? The exhibition became the catalyst for conservation work on some of the key sculptures in both Italy and America. The San Tommaso Madonna, conserved thanks to the Friends of Florence. The Visitation, which you see before and after. And the Prudence in the Metropolitan, as I mentioned, the order of the border pieces has been changed. So the show has contributed to understanding of how these artists worked. In their own time, the Della Robbia won admiration even from Leonardo da Vinci. He praised their ability to make colors eternal, perhaps envious because so many of his paintings with experimental techniques began to deteriorate early. But this comparison suggests that he also admired Luca as an artist. The glazed terracotta sculpture, the Della Robbia, enjoyed great popularity for 100 years before that popularity faded for reasons of supply and demand. The ability to do this kind of work really well was lost, and the growing conception of art as an expression of genius encouraged patrons of sculpture to prefer nobler materials like marble and bronze. But the results of the Della Robbia's prolific century can still be seen throughout the world today. In one of our galleries, we quote Walter Pater's famous 1873 passage on the Della Robbia. "I suppose nothing brings the real air of a Tuscan town so vividly to mind as those pieces of pale blue and white earthenware, like fragments of the milky sky itself, fallen into the cool streets and breaking into the darkened churches." He goes on, "And no work is less imitable. Like Tuscan wine, it loses its savor when moved from its birthplace, from the crumbling walls where it was first placed." We beg to differ. Both good Tuscan wine and the Della Robbia sculptures can keep the savor of Tuscany and bring it to us here in the New World. The appeal of Luca, the founding father, was equally well summarized by the great art historian John Pope Hennessy. Luca, Sir John noted, was the most popular sculptor of the 15th century. He coined a language more universal than that of Donatello, and his sculptures are accepted for the human consolation or the acute aesthetic pleasure that they offer by a vast public to which Renaissance art is all but a closed book. We hope that even if the Della Robbia are already familiar to you, this exhibition will open the book. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.